This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. What'd you say your name was again?
His name is Django Freeman.
Why'd you dig him up?
Well, fortuitous turn of events brought Django and myself together.
Quentin Tarantino's ode to spaghetti westerns, Django Unchained, has brought Adam and me together. We'll see whether it proves to be a fortuitous turn of events or not.
We'll also close out our Blaxploitation marathon with Ganja and Hess and talk to writer, director, and actor Edward Burns about his new holiday release.
Forget It's a Wonderful Life. We've got your very special Blaxploitation Christmas ahead on Film Spotting.
Django! Django, have you always been
Film Spotting is presented by MoviePass. You can see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate.
Just purchase your ticket at the movie theater kiosk seamlessly with the MoviePass app and card. For your exclusive chance to sign up now, go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and get $10 off your second month.
That's moviepass.com/filmspotting to start your membership.
You're listening to Film Spotting. What's that line from Clerks, Josh? I'm not even supposed to be here today.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to be here today. We were planning a week off originally for the holidays, but here we are somehow opening the doors of the Quick Stop. We just couldn't resist rounding out our Blaxploitation marathon, sharing my conversation with Ed Burns about the Fitzgerald Family Christmas, and of course, dissecting Django Unchained.
Do you know what a bounty hunter is? You kill people, and they give you a reward.
Better they are, bigger the reward.
I need your help. I'm looking for the Brittle Brothers. However, I don't know what they look like, but you do. Don't you?
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who to.
That means we visit every plantation until we find them.
Once a final Brittle Brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom, and I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
Yes!
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention.
Josh, since you joined the show in January, I've had a few of those I'm glad I didn't know that when I hired him moments.
Shocking.
Yes. And I had another just a week or so ago when we got an email from a listener, Adam Langford in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He wrote in with this. With the Django Unchained buzz in the air, I was hoping you would revisit Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, especially now that you have Josh on board. His review, which rips the film for its moral dizziness, directly contradicts the glowing praise that Adam and Maddie gave the film while naming it their top film of 2009. Josh's take on the film is the most precise I've read by a mile. The problem with the film is not that it bastardizes historical truth or that it promotes Holocaust denial. The problem is that it genuinely promotes immoral violence, including torture, suicide bombing, and collateral damage as heroic accomplishments. I feel like we're getting back into the Zero Dark Thirty discussion all over again. But I read that email from Adam. I thought, okay, that's a great email. It's a fascinating topic, one I'd like to discuss with you sometime on air or probably off, because it just wasn't really going to fit into our schedule to revisit Inglourious Basterds anytime soon.
It's not quite a sacred cow yet.
No, it isn't. And I didn't want to turn our Django review into a referendum on Bastards. But then I saw Django, and while I still don't want to turn this into a referendum on Bastards, Adam's challenge did take on a greater weight because the two films are undeniably similar, at least in their broad strokes. They're not only ultra-violent historical revenge tales, but the avenging agents in both are the victims of two of the most horrific atrocities that human beings have ever committed. In Bastards, it's a team of Jewish soldiers that's doing one thing, and one thing only, killing Nazis. In Django, it's a slave, played by Jamie Foxx, who becomes a bounty hunter under the tutelage of Christoph Waltz's Dr. King Schultz, who focuses on doing one thing and one thing only, killing bad white people, and rescuing his slave wife, played by Kerry Washington, from plantation owner Calvin Candy. That's Leonardo DiCaprio. So was Django essentially Inglourious Basterds part deux for you then, Josh? Or if we're going to go chronologically, Inglourious Basterds the beginning? Were you again deterred by Tarantino's moral dizziness, or has his sensibility gotten at all more sophisticated and stimulating for you?
Well, first of all, I think we've learned you should do more research before hiring someone, clearly.
Absolutely. Background checks.
Exactly. I think Django Unchained makes us morally dizzy, but it's not morally dizzy itself. And that's an important distinction. This movie is very clear about what it wants to do, and it does something that other Tarantino films besides Inglourious Basterds do, and that's use genre style to make us wrestle with the allure of righteous revenge. And I don't want to get into Bastards too much now either. I think that is a good conversation to have. But basically, I felt like Bastards tried to do some of that wrestling itself and failed at it.
Okay.
It's just not what Tarantino, at least as of yet, his films we've seen that I've seen, seems built for. This guy is great at indulging his sort of instinctual delight over genre violence, throwing it up on the screen in all its tantalizing glory, and then letting us figure out what to do with it. That's what his good movies force us to do. When the movies themselves try to intellectualize the moral messiness, as I think Bastards did, I think they kind of find themselves in deep water and they don't quite know how to swim. So let's get back to Django.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Tarantino's best film since Jackie Brown
because
it has that sense of clarity. My problem hasn't ever been with the content of Tarantino's films. It's just been with the attitude behind it, or maybe the nothingness behind it, getting back to our discussion of Pulp Fiction, which I think is his second best film. After Jackie Brown, actually. So this was a real delight for me. I saw Tarantino focused. I saw him unapologetic. And I saw him getting down to business, provoking us in the ways he's wonderfully done before.
That's really fascinating because I came into this discussion based on obviously having read your Inglourious Basterds review and considering their similarities, thinking there was no way you were going to fall for this film. I thought you would have similar problems with it as you did with Bastards. I'm glad we're not going to go too far down that path of trying to reconcile this movie with Bastards. The simple fact is I value that film a lot more than you, and I think that the things that work about Django also very much worked in Inglourious Basterds. And I am going to touch on some of them just in terms of the craftsmanship and the construction. I think the elements that work here very well were also on display in Bastards. And you talk about whether or not we should intellectualize it too much, whether Tarantino's intellectualizing it too much. I can't help it. I'm going to a little bit before we get to some of that basic craftsmanship that I think Tarantino just excels at. What I really responded to here is the way I think Tarantino uses the meta-ness of the film. And we've talked about this, how there's a few blaxploitation elements in the way every character gets their own song. You have an empowered black man, obviously, at the center of this story in Django, played by Jamie Foxx. You also have that character ultimately getting the upper hand on white establishment. So we've seen those elements play out through our blaxploitation marathon. They're on display here as well, even though the film on the whole is much more of an ode to Sergio Leone in the spaghetti westerns.
Right.
And all of the similarities you see between Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name character in Django in this film. But what I think Tarantino gets is that he uses that meta-ness to comment on cultural myth-making. I don't think it's just about masturbatory movie geekdom, as a lot of his detractors like to argue. He gets that our myths largely come from the movies. They're the most potent way to make something part of the zeitgeist. Cinema accomplishes that. And so what he's done here in a really fascinating way is he's turned the oppressed into the oppressors, once again, as he did in Bastards, but he's taken the myth of the exceptional Negro or the magical Negro, this trope that's played out throughout culture, especially in cinema, and just obliterated it by giving us a black man who's exceptional largely because of his ability to kill bad white people. Not serve or help white people, which is what the exceptional Negro usually does, but to kill them. He's taken this figure and exaggerated it to its extreme. And even better, here it's the white person largely serving the black man. It's Dr. Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz, who is using his talents to help Django achieve his ultimate goal and find his wife and risking his life in the process. So I just think it's a brilliant subversion of cultural stereotypes. It's no Casa de mi Padre, Josh. I'll grant you that.
Well, few films are.
Right. But I do think it brilliantly subverts a lot of those expectations. And I also think there's value in the way it depicts the real ugliness and the graphic nature of not only slavery, but racism. That's more relevant to us today, and it still obviously very much exists today. I think Tarantino here cuts it down to its core. He shows how it's based on hate and fear, and that that hate and fear can lead to repulsive acts. And you don't have to look any further to see that relevance in our culture than to see a Tumblr site like Hello There Racist showing how some people responded to Obama getting reelected, or just the other weekend when the Patriots game got preempted by President Obama's speech at Newtown, Connecticut. And you can see all the Twitter posts and all the social media output that was deploring this black man getting on their screen interrupting their football game. It's still relevant, obviously. It's still out there. And I think he really exposes it in a way that is valuable.
You mind telling me what the hell are you doing?
I confirmed that Cornelia's at Candyland.
Sure as hell.
He didn't call her by name, but she's a young lady, whip marks on her back, and speaks German. Now, while it's not wise to assume in this instance, I think it's pretty safe. Point being, don't get so carried away with your retribution. You lose sight of why we're here.
You think I lost sight of that?
Yes, I do. Stop antagonizing Candy.
I'm not antagonizing. I'm intriguing him.
You're yelling abuse at these poor slaves?
I recall the man who had me kill another man in front of his son, and he didn't bat an eye. Remember that?
Yeah, of course I remember.
What you said was that this is my world. And in my world, you gotta get dirty. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting dirty.
You're hitting exactly upon one of the reasons why I did like this film so much compared to his other pictures. I think he has been guilty of that genre masturbatory, just doing it for the sake of having fun with these tropes. Kill Bill, especially, I would say. Here, it's definitely done more for a purpose. And for all of the pop cultural references, all the other movie references here, I can think of very few films that I've seen that give the historical reality of slavery its due like this one does. I mean, Django Unchained forces us to pay attention to things like the spiked collars, the merciless dogs, that hot box that Kerry Washington's character, Broomhilda, is forced into after she tries to run away. I know that other films have addressed these things, but we normally don't get them in movies like this. And I think it's important that we do have them, not only because of the contemporary resonance you mentioned, but because slavery isn't something we need to just get past all the way necessarily. We need to have reminders like this. And it was astonishing to me, to be honest with you, to see them appear in a movie like Django Unchained, which also functions quite well as quote-unquote entertainment, I'd argue. And here's just another brief aside where I think it is distinguishable from Inglourious Basterds in that Django Unchained makes me feel the weight of slavery that Bastards never really made me feel the weight of the Holocaust. So that's one distinction as well I made.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're discussing Quentin Tarantino's new film that just was released on Christmas Day, Django Unchained. It's playing now in wide release. And clearly we both responded to the moral nature of this film, that there is something that Tarantino is wrestling with there. And I think that as much as people criticize Bastards, and people will criticize this film if they haven't already, for its revisionist fantasy, being this revenge fantasy, my response to that is, where else should a revenge fantasy live but within a historical context, within something that is very clearly just that, a fantasy? I don't think that Tarantino is suggesting that an eye for an eye is the way the world necessarily is now or the way he thinks the world should be. He's not holding it up as any kind of ideal. But in a movie placed in that historical context, and we see it within that context, why can't we revel, just a little bit revel, in seeing the worst people alive? I think we can say that. People who, as I suggested in the setup, not only the Nazis with the Holocaust, but the people who committed slavery. Why can't we watch those worst people get their comeuppance? I think that through fantasy, that actually does help define our values, our present day values.
Let's talk about some of those worst people, because I think there are some very interesting performances going on here. And already there's been a lot of division over DiCaprio's performance as Calvin Candy, the plantation owner. He's doing something pretty nuanced here, actually. He gets the showy parts that are in the trailers and in the commercials, and those are definitely in the film for the expected Tarantino comic tension scenes that you do get in this movie. But he's also trying to wrestle as a guy who's part of this family history. He's really recognizing in an after-dinner speech he gives at one moment that he lives within a genealogy of industrialized inhumanity that even he doesn't fully understand.
Right.
That's a fascinating speech.
It is.
And then there's the real bad guy in this movie, in my mind.
We'll get to him.
And that's
or we can get to him now. Yeah.
Well, Samuel Jackson's Stephen, who's this aged house slave who studied so closely at the feet of his brutish masters. He's glowering in some scenes, simpering in others, and always knowing how to manipulate which way he should be at a certain time. And what we see here is this personification of the way evil can corrupt so wholly that it turns its victims into perpetrators. This is one of Samuel Jackson's most frightening performances.
It absolutely is. And I'll touch on DiCaprio first. He has so much fun with this role. He's clearly relishing every line without ever crossing over into being cartoonish. I think he makes us believe this character. He's certainly someone we don't have any sympathy for, but we buy into this character who seems so comfortable with confronting human misery. He just revels in the pain and suffering of others, but not because he's inherently evil. As you said, it's because he largely just feels entitled to it. And that sense of entitlement really comes through in DiCaprio's performance. I just love the range of it. I mean, this is a performance that goes from 0 to 100, but doesn't ever feel like he's chewing scenery. Never felt like that to me. I think he actually outdoes Christoph Waltz in the sense that he's almost the Colonel Landa character that Waltz was in Inglourious Basterds. I think he's just as good or certainly close to how good Waltz was in that film. And you're right about Samuel L. Jackson. The thing that really comes through with his character, and he really is the true villain of this film, the movie makes that clear. And here's how I think it makes it clear, is because what you become aware of is that he had a choice. He had a clear choice to become the, quote, head Negro. That's the role he takes in the home. And we get, I believe, Jamie Foxx's character, Django, at one point says, there's nothing worse than that character. And the reason why is because he had that choice. Slaves don't have a choice. They just have to be slaves. But he had a choice to either go on being a slave like the rest of his people or to get better treatment, to take on some authority, to sell out his people. And he made that choice, and he took it, and he has to pay for it.
And he's an active participant in their torture and abuse. I mean, that's another raw fact that the movie throws at you.
Exactly.
That's really unnerving.
Baby, you on Stephen's bad side, or you need to be on his blind side.
You say you ain't no
one. Huh?
I said, you said you ain't know him.
I don't.
Yes, you do.
Mr. Stephen, I don't.
Why is you lying to me?
I...
Then why is you crying?
You scaring me.
Why is I'm scaring you?
I want to talk about Jamie Foxx a little bit because I'll have to see the film again to get a better sense of it, but I think he might actually be giving the best performance in the film because he underplays everything and really makes Django a human character in a way that maybe someone like Shaft, who he's clearly modeled after, never became. Now, granted, Fox plays up those moments of righteous retribution. I'm thinking of the first time he does so when they're on another plantation and he comes between an overseer and a slave who's about to become whipped. That's an amazingly staged and framed scene by Tarantino where Django becomes this sort of Superman slash Shaft character.
Yeah.
And Fox plays those for all it's worth. But really what he seems more interested in emphasizing to me are the scenes that evoke the quiet exhaustion and the romantic longing of this character. I don't think we should downplay the role that Kerry Washington and Jamie Foxx have in making us really rooted. At least I was really rooted in their story. And we don't see them together all that often.
No, we don't.
There are little fantasy sequences, which is something new from Tarantino, at least in my eyes, that recognize natural beauty. They often take place outside where Django imagines Broomhilda seeing him and them being reunited. We get little dollops of those throughout the movie that really added up to me to make their relationship central here. And Fox plays him primarily as that longing romantic figure. I think what that ultimately does, at least for me, is elevate Django Unchained in that we get this sense of real humanity within Tarantino's circus atmosphere, and they offer in their relationship a way forward, a way out of the hatefulness and the violence and the revenge. When you were asking your question, isn't there some value in seeing the worst people get this and having us kind of wrestle with that? There is, but it's nice also to see here a little bit of a way forward. Now, I'm not trying to downplay the fact that Django is directly involved in that retribution too, but there's also that other side to him.
I like Jamie Foxx here as well, but I did feel like maybe he gets lost a little bit in the showiness of some of the other performances. And I use that word showy loosely because I don't think anybody overdoes it. But when you have Samuel L. Jackson's performance and you have Leonardo DiCaprio's performance and you also have Christoph Waltz, again, doing great work here and doing different work than he did in Inglourious Basterds, there's a similarity to their characters, this sense of decorum and a sense of order and structure, but he's much more playful here. I mean, he's obviously a good guy here and he's vile in Inglourious Basterds, but there's a sense with Dr. King Schultz, and you do have to acknowledge there's something very playful Tarantino's doing with the name Dr. King for a white character who frees Django. He's genuinely enjoying life. He's not using his sense of decorum and his authority just as a way to disarm people, which is what he did in Bastards. So I really like the elements that he brings to this as well. But maybe Jamie Foxx and his character, I would say his character more than his performance, get lost a little bit in this. Sometimes Django feels like a secondary character within what is very clearly his own film.
I think that might have been purposeful.
Maybe.
And that's kind of what I'm wondering. And if so, I really appreciate that aspect.
I do want to touch on some of the things that I just think from a pure storytelling standpoint stand out here and are the things that clearly Tarantino has shown he can do so well over the years. I don't know if any of the scenes in this film, and there are some great sequences, I don't know if any of them scream instant classic to me, like at least two of them did in Bastards. I'm thinking of the opening interrogation and also the underground pub sequence with my guy, Michael Fassbender. But scene after scene, they're just so well constructed from a writing and directing standpoint that they're like their own little movies within the larger movie. Every scene has its own beginning, its own middle, and its own end. And the way Tarantino builds tension and suspense, just bit by little bit, it just keeps getting ratcheted up. And there's even anticipation before the conversation starts. I can't think of another filmmaker who finds a way to make us want someone to say something just to break that ice, because there's so much tension just building in the anticipation of them having some kind of showdown, and not even a physical showdown, just a showdown of words. And that is always fun for me to watch. And the way he does it is not through a lot of dramatic cutting or within the conversations using a lot of music. He just has a lot of patience and trust in the actors, and he'll have them withhold information sometimes, or he'll use the camera to just sort of slyly introduce new information that changes everything about the dynamic of the scene. And I love too that in Tarantino's world, and we talked about this with Pulp Fiction a lot, words matter. What people say, how they say it, the phrases they choose, those really matter. And because you get clued into the impact and the consequences of people's words, that makes you as a viewer even more attentive to every word someone's saying.
I like how you describe these scenes as mini movies. I think that's very true. And I think you're also right that Django may not have – sometimes these have to bubble up after a while in your consciousness. But immediately it may not have those standout sequences that are going to make the Tarantino highlight reel at the end of his film. But I think that's one of the questions we have to wrestle with when it comes to Tarantino is how much value do we place on those purely aesthetic, invigorating moments, or do we more appreciate – the far more artful moments that may not be as flashy or as showy, but what he's doing in them is a little more interesting. And I guess I wrestle with that. It's one of the reasons I love Jackie Brown so much is I don't know if it has even one of those highlight reel scenes. But as a package, I just adore that movie. And, man, I'm just excited to have seen a Tarantino film in quite a while that's close to that level, which Django Unchained is.
I'm glad to hear that, obviously, because I'm a huge fan of this film, and I'm glad that you responded to it positively as well. I think you're right that you wrestle with that a little bit more than I do. I tend to get blinded by some of those aesthetic choices and just respond as a pure cinephile to some of those moments. And I like Jackie Brown a lot, too, but you say it's his best film, and it's definitely his least stylized, as you said. It's his least splatter-filled, and I hate this term, but his critics would say it's his least self-indulgent. I like it, but I would probably rank it below every one of his other films for me, because I tend to respond to that artfulness and the artifice a little bit more than you do. And one of the ways that comes through in Django that I really responded to, again, is the way he takes such pleasure in the power of performance. It goes back to Reservoir Dogs. It goes back to the conversation on that rooftop where the undercover cop is telling Mr. Orange, Tim Roth, that to be a good undercover cop, you have to be Marlon Brando. You have to be naturalistic. You have to be naturalistic as hell. Think about throughout his films, especially in Inglourious Basterds, how many times we see characters having to take on a role. They are being actors within this film. Within the story, they have to play up a certain persona or behave a certain way that may actually be completely contradictory to who they are in real life. We certainly see that here with Django having to take on a character of a black slaver, which would be the worst thing he could possibly do.
And
but he has
Schultz
to play that
talk,
role.
They talk about their
they
roles, too.
They talk explicitly about having to stay in character. And what I love, what we've seen in these past two films, and actually we saw it in Reservoir Dogs too, is that when characters get into trouble, when they start to suffer certain consequences, is when they break character. It's when they betray themselves, when they stop being a quote-unquote good actor and something happens and some truth is revealed and they end up getting hurt. And what I love here that's added in Django Unchained is that without spoiling anything, we get a character at the end who finally just decides, I can't play this character anymore. I'm so horrified by what I've seen, by the behavior of this plantation owner, the detestable nature of treating human beings as if they're subhuman, that, you know what, I don't care what the consequences are. I'm going to break character, and I'm going to be my true self. And I love that that element comes through here. It's just fun for me to watch these characters in Tarantino films take on these personas and play these roles. And just like with the dialogue, I think that just tunes us in even more to the art of the performance on screen. That is Django Unchained. It is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter, @filmspotting, and Facebook.com/filmspotting. Josh, how did we get through this entire review without noting that the only terrible moment and the only moment of terrible acting is Quentin Tarantino's own moment?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I'll agree.
The movie does, just like in Pulp Fiction, many would argue, and I would argue, the movie takes just a little bit of a nosedive when he appears on screen. You think I do bad accent work in Massacre Theater?
Yes. Why he gave himself an accent? That is a good question.
Quentin, you got to just let it go.
Well, we'll light up some ganja and Hess next as the final film in our Blaxploitation marathon. Stay with us.
Django! Django, have you always been alone? Django! Django, have you never loved again? Love will live on all. Life must go on for. For you cannot spend your life. Now your love has gone away. Lost you lovers.
Adam and Josh and Film Spotting listeners, this is Steve Procopi, Capone from Ain't It Cool News with my choice for the best film of 2012. And there were quite a lot to choose from, everything from The Avengers and Cabin in the Woods to Zero Dark Thirty and Moonrise Kingdom and Looper and Argo and The Master, and certainly Holy Motors was a contender. But my pick actually is going to be Beasts of the Southern Wild from writer-director Ben Zeitlin, who quite simply gave us a glimpse into a world that I have never seen represented on screen before. It's elegant, it's magical, it's mysterious, it's provocative. And it features two of the best performances by first-time actors that I have quite frankly ever seen in my life, that of a young girl named Covangene Wallace and a man named Dwight Henry, who played a daughter and father living in the Louisiana Bayou. And really what the film shows us is a death of a culture due to both nature and man-made disasters. The film kind of spins around your brain and it challenges you and your beliefs about what living is. And that might be too much for some people, but I think it's a feeling that should be embraced on a regular basis. And I could watch this film a dozen more times and see something different in it each time. And for the record, that's something that happens very rarely with movies these days. So see the film for your sake and for the enrichment of your soul. It's out on DVD now. Thank you, guys. I hope to see you guys soon. Bye.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Steve Procopi, our buddy Capone from Ain't It Cool News, who was supposed to be part of our Top 10 Films of 2012 show last week because his number one film of the year, as you heard there in that voicemail, Beasts of the Southern Wild, was also your pick. So he would have been there to support you, Josh.
I kind of feel like there was some sort of conspiracy going on, actually, because when I mentioned Beasts, it was kind of quiet. Yeah. I didn't get a ton of support from the roundtable. Now I find out this voicemail...
You knew the voicemail existed.
You're not going
to
buy that, huh?
Don't try to hide it. Don't try to blame it on me, Josh. I wasn't keeping it secret from you, but I really do regret that we weren't able to fit it in the show. Steve is a regular contributor to our Top 10 show and comes on the show periodically throughout the year as well. If you want to hear that Top 10 Films of 2012 show, both parts are available at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Just do a search for Film Spotting there. And we're going to have even more year in review live at Main Stage here in Chicago on Sunday, January 6th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. Been promoting it the past few weeks here on the show. It's Film Spotting's 2012 wrap party.
If we don't sell this thing out, we'll have a problem. My eccentric uncle will come and he'll just stand in the back and shout that Meet Joe Black is the greatest film of all time.
You've heard it.
We don't want that to happen.
Well, we're not too worried, actually, because ticket sales are going okay. I haven't even shared with you the numbers yet, Josh. I need to do that. But ticket sales are moving fine. I think that once we put a little bit more promotional muscle behind it, I'm sure that we're going to get our full crowd there. It seats about 200 people. I will say this. If we don't sell it out, if we can't sell out a 200-seat venue on a Sunday afternoon in our home city, we might need to just stop doing the show.
Really?
I'd say fold up shop.
You're going to make that statement now,
I mean,
huh?
Wow. Really? 200 people?
That kind of sounds like a threat to listeners, actually. Show up or we're done.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way at all, Josh. If you want more information about that live event, just go to filmspotting.net. There's a link to buy tickets in our top stories, or go to mainstage.com and buy tickets there. That's M-A-Y-N-E. Speaking of all this end-of-year talk, we did want to acknowledge that we were really honored to be included in the 2012 Village Voice Film Critics poll. About 85 critics ended up submitting their picks for not only the top 10 films of the year, but best documentary and best performances, some of those different categories that you often hear us talk about this time of year. And those links are out there if you do want to cheat a little bit, if you want to know ahead of time, before our live show, what some of our favorite performances of the year are. You can find our official ballots on the Village Voice website. We'll link to them in our show notes.
Nothing will make you second guess your picks more than knowing it's going to appear in the Village Voice either. That was
so
a lot of pressure for me.
Yeah, no, it really was. And this is a good time for me to acknowledge I buckled under that pressure, because if you look at that poll, that was the first one we had to submit.
That was
December 10th.
Yep.
So I was really cramming some stuff in at the last minute and trying to get prepared and make sure I had a credible list, something I felt proud of. And a few days later, after submitting it, I was putting together our Chicago Film Critics Association ballot. And I was actually in my car and I was just thinking about best actor and who am I going to give my five slots to? And I started debating in my head which performance was better, Joaquin Phoenix in The Master or Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln.
Okay.
I like them both, but I think they're both very different performances. And I was debating this. All of a sudden, the light bulb goes off, and I realize I completely forgot about Phoenix when I submitted the Village Voice poll.
Aha.
I completely forgot about him.
You're going to look like a fool.
Yeah, I'm going to look like a fool. And so Daniel Day-Lewis is in there, but Joaquin Phoenix is not. And I'll just say it now. I had Joaquin Phoenix as my second favorite male lead performance of the year, but he's not there on my Village Voice ballot.
I've had some inconsistency too, so it's okay. I actually moved Amour up on my top 10 for our show,
okay,
which came later after The Voice. I think I moved it up to slot number four.
It
was at six or something like that for Village Voice. So yeah, when it comes that early, it's hard to set everything in stone.
Yeah, it is. But if you do want to check that out, again, we'll link to the Village Voice 2012 poll. There's some interesting stuff there. The Master did end up winning the poll overall, taking in the bulk of the critics' votes. And as someone who did rank that as his number one film of the year, I was definitely happy to see that love go to Paul Thomas Anderson. We have one other poll note to mention. If you go to filmspotting.net right now, we have two poll questions up. You get to weigh in on how you view the year in cinema. Was it the year of the genre film, or was it the triumph of movies like Moonrise Kingdom and The Master, the year of the visionary director, or movies like The Avengers and The Dark Knight Rises? It was the year of the superhero. You can do that by going to our website now. But we're also leaving up our Golden Brick poll. The Film Spotting Golden Brick is our award we give out every year to the film that we think was most overlooked, maybe underrated, that we really want to champion. And often it's by a young filmmaker or a new filmmaker. And we included in our eight nominees, Josh, Cosmopolis, the David Cronenberg film. I thought you made a very good case for it. It's obviously artistically ambitious and a challenging film, the kind of movie we want to support with the Golden Brick. But it's a David Cronenberg movie, so you think, does it really need to be championed by us? Well, it kind of does, because it only made $750,000. So nobody went and saw this film. We put up that poll asking which of these eight films you would pick to be the Film Spotting Golden Brick winner for 2012. And we're getting 400, 500 votes in over 3 or 4 days. It's proceeding how we expected it to. Two films in particular kind of battling it out for the bulk of the votes. The other six nominees only getting 1-5%. And then all of a sudden I wake up one morning, Josh, and I go look at the poll. And the poll numbers have more than doubled overnight. And now Cosmopolis is winning with 54% of the vote.
Some voting shenanigans are going on.
A little bit of voting shenanigans by the twihards out there. I mean, let's be honest, that's what happened. And I found it, and some listeners pointed out there were these different websites that are Robert Pattinson devoted websites, Twilight fan sites, that said, hey, Cosmopolis and our guy Robert Pattinson is up for an award. Let's go flood the site. Let's vote for it.
That's
They're not
unreal.
Doing anything nefarious. I'm not suggesting they are. They want to support the movie. They want to support their guy. So they said, hey, let's go.
Why didn't they go
film.
See Cosmopolis?
That's what
and
I want to know.
Increase the box office
That's
a little more.
But they came to our site, they flooded it with votes, and what we ended up deciding to do is we just had to take Cosmopolis out of the running. It was never going to win. It had like 1% of the vote, and we left it out. We put up a new poll question with just the seven nominees. Our apologies to Robert Pattinson and David Cronenberg.
He's very good in the film. I mean,
they're fans out there. He's very good in the film. I really love his performance, actually, so I feel a little bit bad about it. But we hope that if you did vote initially in the poll, you'll go back and participate, because even though your vote doesn't determine the eventual winner, we do like to acknowledge a listener's choice winner. So go to filmspotting.net and vote now in the 2012 Golden Brick poll.
I want to get a little higher, you know. I want to go on up now.
My official title is Reverend Luther Williams. I also work as a chauffeur and stableman part-time to help support my family. I work for Dr. Hess Green, and he's an addict. He's not a criminal. He's a victim. He's addicted to blood.
We're wrapping up our Blaxploitation Marathon with quite a doozy, Adam. Like all our marathons, this has been a chance to delve more deeply into the work of a particular filmmaker, or the films of a particular country, or the movies of a specific era. While the other Blaxploitation movies we've discussed, which have been Cooley High, Black Caesar, Coffee, Superfly, and Shaft, have all dealt with crime or race in some way, Ganja and Hess is pretty much purely a horror flick. Dwayne Jones, who prior to this paid his horror dues in Night of the Living Dead, stars as Dr. Hess Green, an accomplished archaeologist who specializes in African history, when his assistant, who's played by director Bill Gunn, inexplicably stabs him with an ancient dagger, Hess is cursed with a form of vampirism. I'll confess, I would probably not have gathered all of these plot details if most of them weren't shared in explanatory text at the movie's start. This is a jagged film with surreal flourishes, long dialogue scenes that go nowhere, and no natural sense of the passing of time. Did you take this as a sign of unprofessionalism or perhaps the limits of a low budget? Or were Gunn and his fellow filmmakers going for a nightmarish dream quality that ultimately worked in the picture's favor?
Well, I think it's probably more the latter, except it didn't really work in the picture's favor. I think that Bill Gunn was clearly going for some kind of ethereal, artsy, dreamlike quality to this film and to the horror specifically. And I'm going to give him the credit to suggest that he was probably trying to say something somewhat profound about our attachment to religion and wrestling with some of these big moral questions. But boy, it really doesn't come through in the film as a whole. You're right. Inexplicable is a good word to describe not just some of the actions, but the movie as a whole. You're right that it, at its core, is kind of simple. You have this doctor who does get transformed into a vampire. He eventually meets a woman who was the wife of the assistant who he murders after being turned into a vampire. He turns her into a vampire. And that's really the film. There is a climax to the movie where our main character, Hess, does come to a dramatic conclusion about his life. But otherwise, I have to admit, I felt a little bit bad watching it, as if we made a mistake picking this film for our marathon. Huh. I got to be totally honest, because it was the one movie that really did stand out. We were warned. We were warned by our blaxploitation consultant, Odie Henderson, who you heard during
our... I didn't realize he had a title.
Yeah, he has business cards too, or he should, and we'll help you with that, Odie, if you need him. But he warned us when he looked at our list. He said, and I'm going to quote him here, he said, "When I read that you had selected Ganja and Hess, I said, what the hell? It's chronically underseen, yes, but it doesn't fit the criteria you cited. I think it's an interesting misfire whose one redeeming value is Marlene Clark. She is the love interest, the wife of Hess, eventually in this film. And I agree, she's fantastic and probably is the best part of the film. But he says, I can think of 12 other movies I'd have chosen over this one. However, I suppose I have to think about all types of your listeners. This would be raw meat to throw at the listeners who want to feel like they got something arty out of a genre whose name is a composite with the word exploitation, even though this movie's artiness is actually no budget incomprehensibility. He warned us. He was right. We should have listened.
I don't know. I'm glad we included it, actually. I found this to be so disturbing as a horror film. It wasn't scary. It was just unnerving because of the form it had. It really kind of cast this spell or dream, exactly what the characters are going through, this haze. I kind of felt because of its technique. Now, there are some elements that I think are just low budget or unaccomplished.
Without a doubt.
That get in the way of the more intentional surrealism that's unlike anything else I've seen in a lot of ways. It sort of recalled Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, which we revisited, in its use of subliminal shots that we don't know why they're there or what they're doing, but thrown together as a whole, it really creeped me out. Think of some of the things here that are going on. During one of the sex scenes, there's that ceremonial chime that keeps going on.
Right.
I don't know what's going on there. The church baptism sequence that comes, I mean, this gives the Daniel Day-Lewis dousing in There Will Be Blood a run for its money.
I don't know about that.
It really, I think a lot of it is I don't fully understand what's going on in a lot of these scenes, but there are enough familiar elements, especially the intermingling of Christianity with what we're assuming are African tribal traditions. We almost get these, again, surreal impressionistic reveries of people walking through the plains or grasses wearing tribal garb. We're not sure how that connects. The movie doesn't explain a lot. And to a degree, that's its fault. But for me, it added up to enough just authentic bizarreness that it worked on the level it was going for.
Yeah, I wish it did for me. And you said it's not scary. It's definitely not scary. But for me, it also wasn't ever really creepy or disturbing. I just never had that reaction to it. It never really provoked those feelings in me. I was always kept at a distance with this film. The best way I might describe it to someone who, if you're listening and trying to wrap your head around what kind of movie this really is, it's basically Angel Heart if it was directed by John Cassavetes.
Well, see, I don't know that that's entirely fair. It's the kind of movie...
Which I'd want to see that movie normally if you just
said
that to me.
It's so out there that you can easily throw out references that make it sound ridiculous. And on some level, it is ridiculous. I think it's just one of those. It has nothing to do with Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, but this conversation is reminding me of some I've had with people who have visited that film from Turkey this year, which is very long and working at its own rhythm. And if you don't get in rhythm with it, you're totally going to be out and just, this is not working. Gajan has completely different style,
right?
But it's a mindset that if the movie doesn't cast that spell on you, I completely understand it's going to be hard to get into. For whatever reason, freaked me out.
Yeah, it didn't for me, obviously. And the Shining comparison is a good one because you're right. There are those same kind of subliminal frights going on or subliminal suggestions. And sometimes they're not subliminal. Sometimes it's just going to blatantly cut away to something and shove it in your face.
Yeah, there's a lot of
That might work for me in a lot of films. It does work for me in The Shining. But when we talked about The Shining recently on the show as one of our sacred cows, I mentioned how there's that one completely ridiculous moment in the film where we see someone dressed up in like a dog or
the
bear
dog
outfit.
Man, bear. Did we ever decide what it was?
I looked it up and now I can't remember if it was a dog or a bear. But that's how some of these moments felt in Gajan Hess to me. It felt like it was straining for profundity with the cutaways to the religious artifacts. And so I think part of it, too, is just that it's so hard to really get invested in what's going on because it's hard to hear. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, I didn't see a very good print either.
The low-budget aspect of this film is I don't know who was working the sound or what sound problems they had, but it's very hard to just pick up the dialogue. And then when there is the dialogue, this is the Cassavetes reference I'm making here, the problem is that it doesn't really gel with the style of the film to be this really arty, basically pretentious kind of film, but then it's mixing it with this clearly ad-libbed, naturalistic, casual dialogue that takes you out or took me out of virtually every scene.
Yeah, the conversation scenes don't work at all.
They don't work, and there are a lot of them amidst all the other crazy, goofy montages going on in this film.
Anyway, I don't know. If I really believed in a desire, I don't think it would frighten me so much. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I think I understand. The idea of desire is very much a part of our culture. After all, the Mirthinians thought they had a desire for blood, not a need for it, but it was a need.
I think what we're talking about is hunger.
Do you know what hunger is? I don't know what hunger is.
Not
I mean, I sit here, I eat, I don't know what hunger is. I don't know what hunger is.
I think, too, that Dwayne Jones, as an actor, and probably in how he's written and conceived, I had a problem watching him because he is so much of a blank slate throughout the entire film. In fact, during a lot of the conversation scenes, you'll notice they don't even show him. They just show one side of it, one person talking to him. But rather than that making me more nervous or more tense in a scene, wondering how he's reacting, when we do finally cut to him, he's really not reacting at all. He is completely emotionless in this film and is someone who, because of that lack of emotion, I never really cared about where this was going with him. I didn't feel like by the time it got to his epiphany at the end of the film, it just didn't matter to me.
Yeah, I guess that's one of those areas where the inexperience maybe, or again, just the lack of professionalism, how much of that is a detraction or how much of it, I'm thinking about the conversation you're talking about and how dialogue often doesn't work, but there's also voiceovers that I think are intentional how they use them, and they do work, where they overlap things so that someone will be talking over a dialogue scene. You're also getting an image. You get music. There's some chanting that goes on around
here. Lots of chanting.
And it adds up to this fever dream for me, but I do agree that part of what's going on there is just bad filmmaking.
Josh, you were much kinder to Gajan and Hess than I was, but you acknowledged that there was probably some bad filmmaking going on there. We're going to get to some good filmmaking now, and certainly some good music as you hear Pusher Man, one of the key songs from Superfly, the second film in our Blaxploitation Marathon. We did talk about six movies, and we want to recognize some really good filmmaking, the best moments from our look at this Blaxploitation genre. I'll list the films one more time that we discussed in the marathon: Shaft, Superfly, Coffee, Black Caesar, Coolie High, and of course, finally, Gajan and Hess. Let's start with, fittingly, best music, best soundtrack, where do you go?
I could easily have given it to any of these three. You've got Shaft with Isaac Hayes, Oscar-winning title song. Superfly, just heard Curtis Mayfield. I love how he underlines each groove with an element of sadness. Or Black Caesar by James Brown. And I'm going to go with Black Caesar, actually.
Paid the cost to be the boss. Paid the cost to be the boss. I paid the cost to be the boss. Look at me. You know what you see.
I think his soundtrack is thematically of a piece like the others. That line, paid the cost to be the boss, that mm-hmm. pretty much sums up the entire film. And also, I'm just a sucker for James Brown's music. I mean, I appreciate Hayes and Mayfield, but Brown's records are the ones I have at home.
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of the ones I was really wrestling with here. I went in a different direction, but I love James Brown's music in Black Caesar. You could give it, I suppose, even though it's not original music, you could give a best soundtrack to Coolie High and its appropriation of Motown. I do love how music is used there. And Isaac Hayes and Shaft, come on, it's hard to beat that. But I do think that Curtis Mayfield beats it with Superfly. Not only Pusher Man, but the song Superfly. Those songs are just enduring classics and I think sum up the genre on so many levels. So I was the one who wanted to call this award segment originally the Mayfields because I love those songs so much. It had to be my choice for best soundtrack. What about best supporting performance? We have a lot of very notable lead performers throughout this genre. We'll get to some of those names in a moment, but what about some of the lesser known characters?
I went with Carl Lee as Eddie in Superfly. Eddie is the partner of Priest, the drug dealer who serves as the main character, and he's sort of the devil on Priest's shoulder, you could say. He always pulls Priest back in whenever he suggests that he might want to get out of this business. And Lee is very smooth and snaky in this role. You never trust him, but he does seem to make sense, especially when he's selling the myth that this life of crime is all that he and Priest know how to live. It's mm-hmm. all they know how to do.
Are you going to give all this up? 8-track stereo, color TV in every room, and can snort a half a piece of dope every day. That's the American dream, nigga. Well, ain't it? Ain't it? You better come on in, man.
Of course, the movie overall is a retort to that thinking, but Eddie does make for an awfully convincing foil.
Yeah, he's really good. I definitely considered Carl Lee from Superfly. I also considered Julius Harris as Scatter from Superfly.
Yeah.
There's a great scene between Carl Lee and Julius Harris and Ron O'Neill, the lead in Superfly, that we talked about during the show in the back of his restaurant. Also, I thought about Charles Cioffi as Vic Andrazzi, the cop from Shaft. He's a lot of fun to watch. Booker Bradshaw is the bad guy in Coffee is another one. But I had to go with the real villain for me of the entire Blaxploitation Marathon. It was Art Lund as McKinney from the film Black Caesar.
My shoes are all scuffed. You shine them up for me, boy, like you used to. You kneel down here. Shine them real good. I want to see my face in them. I'm in a real hurry, so you shine them up fast.
That guy is just so fun to hate in this movie. From our first exposure to him, where he sees the young Fred Williamson character as a boy, probably only 10, 11, 12 years old, and accuses him of stealing $50 from him or shorting him on what he had coming to him, and then savagely beats him and leaves him crippled for the rest of his life. And then he comes back or remains an antagonist to our protagonist throughout the rest of the film. And it's unfortunate that his undoing, his comeuppance, has to come at the expense of our hero as well. There's no real moment of glory where we just get to see the black character take down the bad white guy, because there's a tragic downfall element to his character as well. But he's a really scary, really bad character, and I like Art Lund's performance a lot in Black Caesar. What about best lead performance? And I suppose, although we've listed some of the names, we should review them real quick. The star of Shaft, Richard Roundtree. Ron O'Neill as Priest from Superfly. We had Pam Grier, we're including her in the mix, of course, you have to, as Coffee. Black Caesar starred Fred Williamson. Cooley High had more of an ensemble, but I think you could look to Preacher and Glenn Turman as the star of that film. And then finally with Ganja and Hess, we talked about Dwayne Jones a little bit. So who are you giving your award for the best lead performance?
I thought about Glenn Turman, actually, because
yeah, I
think that was a really affecting performance he gave. But I did end up going with Ron O'Neill, who's just so sorrowful as Priest in Superfly, this New York City cocaine dealer who lives the high life, this life of crime and wealth, but he still walks around with these really heavy shoulders. And it's not guilt exactly that's bothering him. It's just this growing realization that the one thing his money hasn't been able to buy is his independence.
What do you do when you get out?
I don't know. Not so much for what we do. It's having a choice. Being able to decide what it is I want. Not just to be forced into a thing, because that's the way it is. Gonna buy me some time, baby. Some time that isn't all f***ed up with things we gotta do. Just to be free.
And will that make you happy?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know I can't be happy the way it is now.
O'Neill infuses this performance with a restless dissatisfaction that you can detect. He's even distracted during the sex scenes, and when he snorts his own product, you can tell he's doing it to gain confidence for this business that he's trying to conduct. The movie and this performance really eat away at the entire pimp as God persona, mm-hmm. which is also what the entire film does.
Yeah, I think I can't say it any better. Ron O'Neill was also my choice as the lead in Superfly for our best lead performance in the Blaxploitation Marathon. That brings us to best moment or scene. What stands out for you?
I'm going to stick with Superfly, and it's that still photo sequence that we talked about, which is a little jarring initially because it seems to come out of nowhere, but it's a series of still photographs given different places in the frame. Sometimes there's about four of them that we see at once, and they trace the cocaine from its procurement to its packaging to its sale, and we travel from the ghetto all the way to the upper-class white clients who make up a significant part of Priest's client base. We have Mayfield's music as the backdrop, and director Gordon Parks Jr. took the photos. When we reviewed the film, I compared it to Steven Soderbergh's Traffic in 8 Minutes because of the way it follows the chain of the drug trade. And it really does open up the story, this little section, so that we see it as something that affects all of society, not just this one bad neighborhood.
Ain't I clean, bad machine, super cool, super mean, feeling good for the man, super fly, here I stand, secret stash, heavy bread, baddest bitches in the bed.
Yeah, I think your Traffic in 8 Minutes summary almost convinced me that that was the scene of the marathon, but I ended up having to go with Isaac Hayes and Richard Roundtree and Gordon Parks Sr. and the opening credits, the opening scenes to Shaft.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Oh, I love that too.
Our first exposure to Blaxploitation as this marathon commenced, it's what started our first film, but it was also the start of Blaxploitation for a lot of people on a little bit more of a mainstream level. Obviously, some people were seeing Sweet Sweet Back and the Melvin Van Peebles films, but this was Blaxploitation really getting on a larger stage, and not only the music, but what it says about the Shaft character, how he's kind of this king of New York City, this black king of New York City. He seems to own the streets and everyone makes way for him. And when a car does get too close to him and almost hits him, he gives it right back to him and suggests what they can do with themselves. And I love that he seems to be this real man of the people. It sets up really everything you need to know about who Shaft is in those opening scenes. But more importantly, as we touched on during our discussion, coming across those theater marquees, there's a clear implication by Gordon Parks Sr. that this is your new black hero. This guy has come along to replace Robert Redford and some of these other guys that white America is enjoying going into the cinema and watch at this time. Here's someone for you, he seems to be saying. So with all that, I had to go with the opening scene and the opening credit sequence to Shaft. We also thought we would throw in a fun one here that just relates specifically to this marathon. I'm not sure that you could apply it to any other marathon. It's the best sticking it to the man scene.
We couldn't have done this with Brisson?
No, I don't think we could. Best sticking it to God scene?
There you go.
Maybe.
All right, sticking it to the man. Well, we both had our problems with coffee, especially the way it simultaneously celebrates coffee's independence while objectifying her. And I particularly noted how I was underwhelmed by Greer's performance here, at least compared to what I was expecting. She was struggling to define her persona beneath all that objectification. Yet, I do think that Coffee's final confrontation with the boyfriend who had been using her and betraying her throughout the film, I think it has that raw, righteous power that Greer would eventually draw on and claim and would use to create the persona that we now know. It's where you see Pam Grier being born in a lot of ways. So even though it's in a movie that's not successful overall, it's going to be my sticking it to the man scene.
I love that choice because I didn't even consider it. And the reason why is not only did I kind of dismiss Coffee as you did, but I was thinking it had to be a scene where the black character was sticking it to the white man.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that too.
But here we go full circle now back to Django Unchained.
Little
bit.
On
some level. And he's another character. It's a black man, but someone who has completely sold out his people and has become the man or has done everything he can, and there are terrible consequences to his actions, to become like the establishment. And so that's a really, really interesting choice. I like it a lot. For me, I'm going back to Black Caesar, and I regret that I wasn't able to rewatch the scene. I just didn't have time before we sat down here, and I did want to get some of the specifics of the scene. But as I recall it, it's the scene with my favorite villain, my favorite supporting performer, Art Lund, McKinney, in Black Caesar, where he's sitting at a table at a house, like in a basement, and Fred Williamson goes to have a conversation with him and basically says, I'm part of you now. I'm part of this mafia. I've joined the club, so to speak. And he says, there's no way these people are ever going to allow a black man. And of course, that's not how he said it, but they're never going to allow you into this club. And he says, oh, really? And basically walks them downstairs. And they say, yeah, he's one
good
of us
scene.
Now.
I
he
like
gets
that
to
one.
Really stick it to the guy who has been his nemesis his entire life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he gets to say, you know what? Now I'm in charge here. I have some power now, and what you thought was unthinkable before has now become a reality. So that's my favorite sticking it to the man scene. And that brings us to Best Picture. What was your favorite film of the six we watched, Josh?
It was pretty clear for me, even though I really liked a lot of these. I went with Superfly. It just shocked me the way Superfly is the antithesis of what the common pop cultural perception of the pimp dealer figure is. It's not this noble stud criminal that's putting one over on the man. That's sort of been fed to us by crime glorifying gangster rap or unenlightened hood movies. This instead is a portrait of crime as a form of it's sort of a spiritual prison that Priest is in, and it's almost always going to lead to a literal prison is the sense you get from this movie. I think it's a really daring movie, even if it's one whose meaning unfortunately seems to have been lost on some generations that have followed it. It's just a real delight to encounter this film.
Yeah, I went with Superfly as well for my Best Picture, and I could see some people taking issue with that choice in that it may not live up to the expectation of blaxploitation in terms of being more of a romp, being more of a good time, really reveling in the exploitation as some of the films, Coffee, for example, does, and maybe being too pretentious, trying to have its cake and eat it too, trying to have some of that pimp element to it and the crime and the drugs and the white women and all the luxury that his character has, while at the same time condemning it and saying, I don't want this anymore. So if people do have that objection, that's fine. But for me, the combination of the things we've touched on, the music, the Ron O'Neill performance, all of those blaxploitation elements, but then having a conscience about it and trying to say something profound beyond just the entertainment value of now we've empowered a black man and he's going to stick it to the bad white people. That is subversive and valuable in its own right. But sure. I love the fact that there is also this element of social commentary where you have a character saying, you know what, I'm doing everything I thought I was supposed to do. I've got all these things that are supposed to make me happy. And I'm realizing that what I don't have is my freedom. I don't have the right to do whatever I want to do. I'm still locked into this prison. So there is some substance in addition to the style that I certainly did not expect when I went into the movie Superfly. I knew the music, I knew the name, I knew some of the tropes of the film, but that was it. And then I was really taken by surprise, as you were, I think, by really what was being said, what messages were being imparted in that movie as well. So Superfly also my standout film, but I considered Shaft, I considered Cooley High. For me, though, I think Superfly is the one that I'm far from an expert on blaxploitation, having only seen six films. But if someone came to me and said, where do I start? I can only watch one. I'd say Superfly.
Yeah, probably. Where would I start? Maybe Shaft. But the best Superfly. Yeah.
I'm with you on that. Hopefully you followed along. We did see some of your comments on Twitter and in the email bag, also on Facebook, that there were definitely people out there following along with this Blaxploitation marathon. That's part of the fun for us, is not only exposing ourselves to these holes in our cinematic educations, but having you play along and exposing you to these films as well that you may have overlooked. So we do hope that it was a valuable experience for you. And we've been on record about our next one. We're going completely different direction. Is it the Marx Brothers?
Marx
next?
Brothers are next. I know they're up. They're in line. They're going to be next.
I think Marx Brothers
is
up next. It's going to probably not start until around February or at least late January, but we'll have more information about that marathon in the coming weeks. And if you want to see a recap of all of our picks for the Best of the Blaxploitation Marathon or revisit some of our discussions, just click on the marathons link at filmspotting.net.
We get a bit more seasonally appropriate next as Adam interviews filmmaker Ed Burns about his latest project, The Fitzgerald Family Christmas. Stay with us.
We should ask Mom to let him come for dinner.
Look, call me cold-hearted prick. I'm not feeling that much sympathy for him.
Why? What did he do that was so bad? He walked out on us?
He never came to one of our birthday parties. You know, I don't got one picture of me and him together. Not one. Shit, he wasn't even there the day I was born.
No, I know. He didn't do shit for me either, but he is our father, and he's going to be gone in a few months.
And you know, I feel bad for him for that, but I don't think that's a reason for me to forgive him.
Me neither.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That was Caitlin Fitzgerald, Carrie Bechet, and Tom McGeary from The Fitzgerald Family Christmas, the new film from writer, director, and actor Ed Burns about seven siblings struggling with a tough family decision involving their estranged father. Had a chance, Josh, to sit down with Ed Burns here recently when he was in Chicago for an appearance, and I started by asking him about the reception to this film so far. This is a movie that seems to have resonated with audiences in a way that some of his recent films haven't. I was curious why he thought that was.
I think it's a combination of that and also the returning to my Irish-American sort of working class milieu.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that I've met at all of the festivals and the film societies and film clubs where we've taken the film, and then folks on Twitter, you know, they love those first two movies, McMullen and She's the One. And it's been 15 years since I went back to sort of revisit that place. And I think part of it is, you know, it's where I'm from. I know it so well. The minute I sat down to write the screenplay, I could tell I was in a sweet spot. I knew it. I knew I could cover this ground with great authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what they're responding to.
Well, I certainly remember you talking to me about this film a few years ago and how it was all germinating. And you mentioned that it was a return to McMullen. Maybe because of that, I had in mind when I first sat down to watch it about a month or so ago. And I generally don't like to know much about a film before I go in. So I'd really come in as a blank slate. I expected it to be funnier, like McMullen was. And it has some funny moments, but it's definitely a full-on drama. And I'm just wondering if it was a case of me misremembering how you talked about the film and just equating it with McMullen, or did you start out thinking that might be more what it was and it evolved from that?
I sat down thinking I was going to tell another sort of comedy with dramatic elements. But as I was writing the screenplay, I knew that I also wanted to write a sequel to Brothers McMullen, which I've started to outline. So knowing that that would be a comedy, I thought, well, let me stay away from that while writing this screenplay. But it really came, there's a moment in the film where my character sits down with the father and the father breaks the news that he's dying. And that was not something that I had planned out. It wasn't in my outline. It was like we were talking about earlier, when you're writing and you go on the journey, sometimes the characters take you down a path you didn't anticipate. So I had to stop writing the screenplay at that point and then make a decision as to, well, what film do I want to make? You know, do I want to make the film about the big, crazy Irish family at Christmas time and they're having a raucous good time? Or did I want to take a look at a family that suffered some pretty great wounds at the hands of the, you know, of the father, the fact that he'd left 20 years ago? And I thought also about my favorite sort of holiday film, Christmas film, It's a Wonderful Life. And, you know, the great job Capra does with that is you balance the comedy and the drama, you know, the light and the dark. And George Bailey, Jimmy Stewart, has to cover a lot of rocky ground. And I think that's why the ending works so well. You know, as you guys say, there were real stakes and that ending is earned. And I think that's why, you know, I've seen the film, I don't know, 25 times. You can't watch that final scene where he is reunited with his family and the townsfolk come in without welling up with tears. I was writing a Christmas film that a father who walked out on a family was asking to come home and just spend Christmas Day with the family. I knew how that film was going to end. So knowing that I was going to have that payoff, I knew that I wanted to earn it in the same way that Capra did.
Mm-hmm.
So I then decided at that point I was going to go back to page one and rewrite and tell a very different version of the story. And, you know, when you're writing, you never sit down with thinking about your theme, but your theme presents itself during the course of the writing of the screenplay. When I got to the end of the movie, I realized, all right, this is a film that's about forgiveness. It's about redemption. It's about the importance of family. And all of those things, I thought, well, in order for this family to heal, I was going to need for them to address some very real wounds. So that's thinking about all those things. That's when the tone changed. And I went through and basically got rid of a lot of the lighter, funniest stuff. There's some remnants of it in there, but that was sort of the decision.
You talk about the importance of family, and clearly that is what this film is about. You see these people on screen that are your on-screen family. I think one of the treats for people who are familiar with your films watching this movie will be that they're seeing all these people who have populated your other films. They're kind of your off-screen family, too. You've gotten to be pretty close with some of these people and use them again and again. Did you do that deliberately to try to have that kind of built-in chemistry where you got that sense that they were a family and there was no denying that right away?
No, quite honestly, when we that we were lucky in that the minute we started to roll the cameras, that's what we started to see. You know, you had all of these actors, some of which, you know, Anita Gillette and Mike McGlone, who are both in She's the One together, and even Malachi McCourt, who plays the priest, he was in She's the One. They've known one another for 17 years. The minute they were on screen together, you saw that history. And I do, you know, I am not precious about my dialogue. So I'm constantly encouraging the actors to make it their own or always encouraging them to improvise within the scene. And when you have actors that have not only worked with one another a number of times, but are friends and have real history, and then you're asking them to play longtime friends or siblings, they're bringing all of that personal history to those characters. And we were getting just great little moments because of that. The idea, though, was two things. We love working with our friends. We make, you know, sort of lower-budgeted films, so no one is going to make any real money working with us. So it's good to ask your friends to jump in and join you. And as I was writing, I thought about Carrie Bechet, who's been in my last, this is now three films in a row, and Caitlin Fitzgerald, who is in Newlyweds. I was definitely writing two of the sisters for them. And at a certain point, I had, a couple of years ago, I sat down with Mike McGlone, to talk about the sequel to Brothers McMullen. When I was writing this, I said, well, why wait, you know, the 2 or 3 years before I make that film? Why don't I write a part for Mike? And then we had the first film and the last film sort of bookended with these cast members. And Aaron Lubin, my producer, and I then said, hey, why don't we just go through all 10 movies and let's just work with all of our friends. So we made sure we pulled at least one actor from every film. And it was. I mean, it really was a filmmaking family reunion.
Yeah, that it's really fun to watch on screen. But amidst all those friends and familiar faces, you do have to work in a few new faces. Yeah. And you see someone like a longtime character actor like Ed Lauder playing the father here, someone who maybe by name listeners aren't conjuring up the image. But as soon as they see him,
when you see that mug, you'll know who he is.
Yeah. So how does a guy like Ed fit into this mix? How do these new faces fit into this family? Is it something that happens fairly smoothly?
Yeah, it did. Because when, you know, when Mike McGlone read the script, he said, you know, who have you cast as the father? I said, we haven't found him yet. He goes, I'm working with him right now. You need to work with Ed Lauder. Ed and I get on the phone. We talk. Ed is from Long Beach, Long Island, which is two towns over from my hometown. I need this guy to play a Long Island dad. He knew the world inside and out. And again, you know, Ed lives in Los Angeles, and, you know, the way we make these movies, you know, you don't have a nice cushy trailer sitting outside our location. You're going to sit in the location all day with the rest of the actors, and hopefully you're cool with that. And Ed said, that sounds like so much fun. So when Ed shows up, Anita Gillette, he has known Anita since the early 70s when they were both young actors in New York, and they were both friends with Burt Lancaster. So we used to get her all day on set. We got these great Burt Lancaster stories. So Even they had, you know, they had a 30-year plus history. So that was incredible. And the other guy, Tom Guiry, who plays the youngest brother, even though Tom and I hadn't worked together before, I cast him in my film Ash Wednesday, and he had to pull out to go. He got a better part, or a better paying part, maybe, in U-571, the submarine movie.
Uh-huh.
And then years later, we cast him again in a film that we couldn't get off the ground. So he's been part of the family for a good, you know, 10-plus years. We just never got to actually, you know, sit down and roll film with him.
You're listening to Film
Spotting.
Not that
we do that anymore.
We're talking with Ed Burns, the writer-director, and one of the stars of the new film, The Fitzgerald Family Christmas. I say one of the stars because, of course, this is a big ensemble piece, bigger than your recent films. And as I was watching it, I was thinking about you and the screenwriting process and the filmmaking process and wondering if there was a point as you were writing where you said, what have I done here? What have I bitten off by having, I think it's seven siblings?
Yeah.
Seven siblings and the mother and the father and then some other characters in the mix as well. Was that something where you knew right away how many characters were going to be in this film and you stuck to that? Or through the writing process, did that evolve and you started sprinkling in more characters?
I knew I wanted seven. My best friend is one of nine. I have another good buddy who's one of 12. Those two guys, just hearing the crazy stories about what it was like to grow up in a two-bedroom house with, you know, eight brothers and sisters, I knew it was rich with just great drama and some laughs as well. But I thought nine, obviously, or 12 was going to be way too much. How Green Is My Valley is one of my favorite films. I forget how many siblings. I think it's seven. That may be where I got the seven from,
okay. Quite
honestly. But, you know, I like an ensemble. My favorite film of all time is Last Picture Show. It's a film I watch once a year. It's sort of a go-to to remind me, okay, it is okay to tell quiet little stories where the camera is not flying all over the place, where it's just real folk having real honest conversations, dealing with the day-to-day stuff. So I've always been attracted to the ensemble. And trying to think, what if at any point, I remember when my brother saw Sidewalks of New York, which is another big ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, the thing that he really responded to, he says, every scene in that movie is pulp. There's no room for setup because you're telling so many stories. And that's something I thought about while writing this. I was like, all right, I'm not going to have the same amount of time to introduce these folks to the audience. So we're going to just have to get right into the drama and hope that the audience can catch up. Now, I know some of the critics said it was too much and, you know, it felt like somebody called it like a overstuffed Irish stew, some clever devil.
Uh-huh.
but most people seem to sort of have embraced that. And, you know, for me, it was a blast to write. I've never had so much fun writing a script. It's a script usually takes 6 months for me.
Mm-hmm.
This took 6 weeks, my very first draft. I think just because I knew all of these people. The minute, you know, there's a great test I do in writing a script where, you know, you want to read your screenplay and cover up the characters' names. And if you can differentiate the characters by just their dialogue, then you know you found distinct and individual voices. A lot of times that's not the case.
Right.
And in this one, I think because I was, you know, loosely basing these characters on people from my neighborhood, I kind of knew who they were very early on.
I love that you mentioned that test because that brings me to my next question. One of the things I really found fascinating about the movie is I feel like you've visualized and represented these characters so well on screen and given all of these people their due. You don't feel like anyone in this large ensemble is really wasted or on the periphery. If you didn't know anything about them at all, you didn't know their names, you didn't know anything except you saw maybe one scene with them, I really feel like you could tell exactly where they all fall in the family order, just based on how much pain and how much anguish they exude. Like, you could watch that and go, okay, that one got a lot more daddy time than
that one. Yeah,
and you could really just lay it out like that.
Yeah, well, that really came from two things I wanted to do. Growing up in a working class, you know, Irish-Italian neighborhood with all these big families, it was always amazing to see when a family, you know, when they all left the nest, where did they end up? And, you know, I wanted to play with sort of that full range of sort of the different socioeconomic sort of stations that where these different folks would fall. And I have a good friend who, you know, his clan, it's everything from doctors and lawyers down to, you know, a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly I borrowed a little bit of that in this story. The other thing was, again, pulling from another friend's life, he told a great story about how within a big family like that, there are subfamilies. There's, you know, the top three, the bottom three, the middle two. In this case, we have the middle one. And how they had very different experiences and therefore opinions of their parents.
Mm-hmm. I could say that's true with my five. I have four siblings, and there's no doubt that dynamic exists.
So that's what we were going for. And I think because I had those two things in my mind as I built out my bios on the characters and then started to write, and when I said I knew who they were, like that never happens on page one.
Mm-hmm.
On this one, I kind of knew who they were and where they were going.
I like to ask you a personal question every now and again in terms of the character you play and how it may or may not relate to you. I thought about, you know, with Newlyweds, whether or not you were drawing on your own marital experience. And I watch a character like Jerry, who you play in this movie, and he seems to be the guy who is the peacemaker. He's the caretaker. He's the organizer. He wants everything to go smoothly. He wants everyone to be happy. Is that at all like you in real life, or were you stretching to kind of play that part?
I'm definitely much more selfish than Jerry, because I think, you know, when you're a writer, you're always lost in your own head. You know, I don't have time to sort of juggle everything, I guess, that Jerry does.
Jerry, we got to make this happen.
We don't have a say in this.
Did you even talk to Mom?
Yeah, of course I did. All right, and I get both of their point of views, and I'm not taking sides.
My man, you got to have a horse in this race.
Oh, and you think it should be Dad's?
He deserves to be there.
Does he? This is a guy who walked out on his family.
His life had changed. Overnight, he's practically a millionaire after he sells the company.
I still don't understand how that gives you an excuse to walk out on your wife and kids.
And it's a funny thing about the screenwriting process. You know, I'm sure you saw the Woody Allen doc,
mm-hmm.
right? And the scraps of paper in the bedside drawer. I have a version of that where I have notebooks filled with ideas from the 90s. And then the minute I, you know, started to have a laptop I could carry around, I just have files and files of ideas. And recently, I was asked to find something for Brothers McMullen, some memorabilia. And I went into one of my old boxes, and in there I have a piece of paper, and it says, make a movie about your cousin Barry when he lived with Grandma Josie. All right, that's a piece of paper from 1997. It's been in a box since 1997. I come across this last week, and I realized that's what this movie is. Jerry is my cousin Barry, in a way. He is the glue. He is the caretaker. And, you know, the character in my film is Rosie Fitzgerald. My grandmother was Josie Fitzgerald. Josie's husband was a complete piece of shit, horrible human being. And I know that in McMullen, I had the terrible father. He was based on my grandfather. So, you know, you have these notes. And we just had a friend of yours here, a screenwriter, talking about keep those notes in front of you. Here was a note from 1997. That's been in a box, yet somewhere in my subconscious mind, that dynamic was there. And during the course of the writing, that clearly came out.
It's amazing what you can draw from and pull inspiration from. I want to close by asking you about the process with making this film. It's always fun to talk to you about that, as you've seemed to have come up with a system that really works for you in terms of these low-budget shoots and working with your friends and working quickly. And I'm curious if you could just talk about how this one differed at all from your past few films, Newlyweds, Nice Guy Johnny, how it was similar. I know you used a different camera for this one from Newlyweds. You wanted to try to get it a little bit of a different look, and I believe went back to the red. Could you elaborate on that?
Newlyweds, we went at it with, the idea was, you know, we're making the pseudo doc. We wanted to improvise. We wanted to kind of make it up as we went, not really scouting locations, showing up to a bar in the afternoon and saying, hey, can we shoot a scene? This we approached as you would any, let's say, proper film, a fair amount of pre-production. Like we said, we went to the Red Epic, which is the new Red camera. We actually had two cameras working on a lot of the days where we had, you know, up to nine folks. So a bigger size production. That said, you know, we have learned from Nice Guy Johnny and Newlyweds where we don't need the big machine. So on this one, it was sort of like a hybrid where there was a bit of the micro budget approach and then a bit of a sort of a slightly bigger crew to help us execute. Also, we were going for a different look. So the schedule was a little longer because we wanted to take the time to sort of light it the way that Will Rex, our DP, you know, wanted the film to look. But, you know, for the most part, we've settled into this nice pocket where we can make these very good-looking movies at a reasonable budget, which ensures that they make money, and then we hopefully can be back here next year talking to you about the next one.
Well, let's make sure our listeners know where they can find the movie right now.
Oh, yeah. So Fitzgerald Family Christmas is available on iTunes and on demand, which is really the most convenient way to see it. Also Amazon, and we're in theaters this time. Because we're the only holiday film in the marketplace this holiday season, we decided to add a theatrical component as well. So we open here in Chicago and then Boston, you know, just a selected markets, as they say.
Well, Ed, it's, of course, always a thrill to talk with you. Thanks so much for your time. Best of luck with the film and congrats on the success so far.
Amen. Thanks for having us back.
Can we forgive our father just one day, just one normal Christmas?
I had no intention of breaking his family up. What I wanted to do is pull you all together.
When he walked out on this family 20 years ago, I told him he would never set foot in my house again, and I am sticking to it.
You're with your family. That's what we do. We take care of one another.
God, I'm happy to see you.
My thanks again to Ed and his producer, Aaron Lubin, for dropping by the studio. Josh, I was actually talking just after the interview with our producer, Sam, and another friend of mine who's seen a lot of Ed Burns' films about how amazing it is, really. You have to give Ed Burns a lot of credit for what he's accomplished with this filmmaking model he's created, because he saw himself not really getting the opportunities as an actor or director that he was getting before, the opportunities he wanted. So he said, fine, I'm just going to come up with this new model. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to be beholden to no one and be successful at it. And you have to give him credit for that.
Yeah, it's pretty ingenious, actually. I wasn't able to sit in on the interview, but maybe down the road we can get Ed to come on again and do a top five with us or something.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be a problem. He is a big fan of the show, longtime listener, and sat in for an entire show with me once as a guest host where we shared our top five Woody Allen scenes.
Nice.
He's a big Woody Allen nut. So I'm guessing we could probably get Ed back for a top five. And we did consider trying to do a top five like holiday themed film.
Yeah, we had talked about
something
it.
Related to Christmas, and it just didn't work out, but I have a feeling we could get him back on to do something like that down the road. That's it for our Christmas edition, our very special Blaxploitation Christmas. As always, we welcome your feedback. You can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, you can see Django Unchained. It opened on Christmas Day, along with Les Mis and Parental Guidance. We've seen Les Mis, and we've seen Django Unchained, obviously. We both heartily recommend Django Unchained. Haven't seen Parental Guidance, but Les Mis?
We'll probably not see Parental Guidance,
no.
I'll confess.
Les Mis, do you want to throw out a recommendation?
It's worth seeing for the performances, the vocal performances, actually. Anne Hathaway, I'm sure everyone has heard. It really is as good as you have heard. Hugh Jackman is pretty impressive, too. A little clumsy as a musical, as a narrative, but I enjoyed those performances enough.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy those performances enough to recommend it, though I am a big fan of Anne Hathaway's performance in the film. I think that, unfortunately, as she goes, so goes the movie. Opening here in Chicago and in limited release, the film Promised Land, starring Matt Damon, from director Gus Van Sant. I just have to be honest, I love Gus Van Sant. I think I had him among my top five directors of the decade, but something about this film just seems so preachy on its face that I can't get excited about seeing it.
The commercials are not doing it any favors.
They are not, but that movie is out now here in Chicago, as well as Not Fade Away. This is the film from David Chase, the Sopranos creator, the Sopranos head honcho. This is his first foray, I believe, as a director into feature filmmaking, and I've heard some good things about this movie, actually, and I want to see it. So Not Fade Away, out now as well. Next week, we will not have a podcast, but for our WBEZ radio listeners, you will hear a replay of our live show back in June. It was our 400th show, spectacular, and hopefully that'll get you primed for our Sunday, January 6th matinee live show as we do Film Spotting's 2012 wrap party.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ.
And we do say it every week. We single out Tori and Sean, and it's true that we wouldn't be on the air without their guidance here, but especially Candace, and as we think about Sam and Joe, it's not a joke when we say this show wouldn't go without them.
I was just saying how one of the points I made, I think it was with The House I Live In on a recent show, and the audio they found for that made the point much better than I had been doing. So, yeah,
Sam,
they're crucial.
Sam worked it in perfectly. And, you know, I did that job. I did the job that they both do for about 4 years, and I did the job that Sam is now doing for about 5 years. And it's a much better show with them doing that role because of their professionalism, because of their commitment, and just their overall talent. And we would be completely lost without them and Candace as well. So just want to say, as we do hit the end of the year and we look forward to the live show and hopefully another great year of shows, that we appreciate everything they do for us.
We did something a little different with the featured music this week. We had songs from the Django Unchained soundtrack, and you can find more about those at unchainedsoundtrack.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Have a great New Year's. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.